All right, it's time for the Sunday morning session. Welcome to it. All right, we've got another great panel assembled this morning. So let's go around and introduce ourselves. First of all, Heather. Heather, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So maybe tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, I wasn't prepared for that question.
Just a little.
Okay.
Time.
Grew up in Southern Idaho. I live in Salt Lake City with my husband. I've always had problems with my faith, but I was officially disaffected as of last conference. So kind of new to the whole apostate scene, and I'm enjoying it.
All right. Well, welcome to the apostate scene.
Thank you.
All right, Greg.
So I'm very much glad to be here and have become quite a Mormon Expression fan recently. And I guess similarly, I'm kind of new to the apostate scene and am really enjoying calling myself an apostate to everyone that I meet. A process over a long period of time. Although I would say that about 6 months ago, Sunday morning, that process accelerated rapidly. But that was kind of one of many factors. But happy to be here and happy to be able to talk about things that I've been waiting to talk about for so long. It's exciting.
Well, welcome. And Zilpha.
Hey, everybody. Yeah, you probably know who I am. I'm John's wife. I just wanted to say one thing. When I've done conference session reviews in the past, I've had people criticize the fact that we criticize the content of the talks. And I just want to say that that is our purpose here. I mean, if you want to hear what exactly was said in conference, you can listen to the talks or you can read the Ensign. If you want to hear only faithful interpretations of the speakers, you can go to church and again read Ensign articles. This is like the only place we have that we can be critical of what is said. And that doesn't mean that everything that was said needs to be criticized, but the opportunity to do so is the purpose of this review.
So. All right. Thanks, Zilpha. Let's just dive in. This session was conducted by President Eyring. And he opened up and he was talking about that in 1936, which is 75 years ago, the church established the welfare program. This making it the 75th anniversary of the church welfare program. That was sort of the ongoing theme of, this session, at least, church welfare. Which kind of, you know, I often say, and this will come up in the, as we discuss the individual talks. I like church welfare. I like when Christian organizations sort of follow the admonition of like the New Testament and, you know, seek after the poor and the hungry and all that. But some of these talks were more like about the church program than they were about like living the church program. And then there was a strong feeling of patting themselves on the back throughout this whole session.
I guess I kind of thought that they maybe, since they kept talking about the church welfare program and its 75th anniversary, that maybe they should have gone into more detail about exactly what the church welfare program does and like how much money is spent on it and more details instead of all these talks about just be kind to those in need, which everybody hears every Sunday anyway. Like maybe a little bit more about the church welfare program would have been more satisfying for me.
I guess I thought that I missed President Eyring's introduction, and I was kind of listening and thinking about, wow, everybody's talking about temporal issues. Maybe also because we just were listening to Glenn's sort of talk about the Book of Mormon musical recently, but this idea of like the church sort of addressing the temporal issues more than just the marketing message, I thought it was actually kind of nice. I wasn't seeing it from that same perspective, but I was seeing
you're not as jaded as I am.
I'm working on it, but so I I was kind of listening to that and maybe hoping that there was a little bit of, maybe we should address the fact that, you know, the Book of Mormon won't keep your family fed, you know?
Exactly.
And that didn't seem so bad. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. Anybody else think it's strange that the church welfare program is only 75 years old? you know, that's like a full 106 years after the foundation of the church before they got around to establishing the concept of welfare.
Well, they did do the Relief Society, which served that purpose for a long time, taking care of the needy and the ones that are hungry and sick.
Plus, in Kirtland, we were all just dirt broke. So, yeah. I mean, you know.
Everybody was taking care of each other.
The bishop's storehouse was empty.
Right. Yeah. And then you had, like, the United Order and all of that going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of tongue-in-cheek. There were other programs. But, you know, one of the great things about the welfare program, this really isn't a podcast on the welfare program, but it's when the church started becoming more outwardly focused.
That's true.
Rather than just taking care of the members. You know, for the 19th century in Utah, there was the bishop's storehouse and there was all those things. You know, like they said in conference, it was sort of spawned by the Great Depression. And I think it's been one of the hallmarks of the church. Kudos to the church. Yay.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
All right. So the first talk leading off was President Uchtdorf, second counselor in the first presidency. And he started his talk by talking about Saul on the road to Damascus.
Mm-hmm. And he said, the heavens are open again. God speaks through his prophets and apostles.
But... just don't expect him to do it to you.
Right.
Yeah, this was another sub-theme running through this sort of, hey, I know we believe in Revelation, and Revelation is good, and I know you know we're supposed to get all this messaging from the Spirit, but don't expect it, and if you don't have it, then you should just do it anyway.
Just do it anyway. Yes.
Yep. Stop waiting on the road to Damascus for some kind of revelation.
Which really was the theme of the talk, right?
Right.
Don't wait on the road there forever.
Yeah, there's an for skeptics like myself, there's an underlying question in talks like this. You know, Uchtdorf said at one point that answers come in the form of a puzzle.
Yeah.
And
this was a big part for me.
And, you know, and they'll say things like, there's a still small voice. And when we get down to Bednar's talk, he picked up this baton and ran with it further. But how in the world do they know that? I mean, they say with such authority, you don't need revelation. And then they say, truth comes in the form of a puzzle. Well, how the hell do they know that? Well, how can they say all these things over and over again, saying, this is how it is, this is how you get information, blah, 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 blah.
Well, I mean, so Nephi, in First Nephi, he establishes pretty strongly the idea that you're going to learn line upon line, precept upon precept. Alma establishes very strongly the idea that you're going to learn, that you're going to, there's going to be this progression. And so this idea that Uchtdorf goes into with the idea of a puzzle that all fits together is really, I mean, that really works. I run into problems when he says, well, at the end, at the very end, it'll all come
You'll
together.
Start
we'll
to see
it.
See right. the
and,
picture.
And unfortunately, I think as an adult, or as you move into, I don't know how to describe it for other people, but as you move into adulthood, in my mind, you start to see, oh, wait, this is a bunch of different, this puzzle doesn't actually fit mm-hmm. together. You have to depend more and more on just the blind part of faith and not on the building knowledge part of faith.
Well, right. It's less about
maybe
what
I'm missing what you're saying.
What the picture is starting to show, because it's not yeah. coming together.
Right. The picture is starting
like
to show something
here,
really problematic.
One piece there, and it's just not fitting together.
Yeah.
Well, I think you have a key point. I think some people wonder, is the church dealing with a lot of apostasy? I would say probably not. I mean, the number's still relatively small. But what I keep hearing coming from them is these people coming to the church saying, people in the church coming to the authorities saying, this whole revelation thing, it's not working
the way
for
you're
me.
Saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
what's shown in the scriptures.
Right.
But you know, yeah. the church set up by Joseph Smith and is described in his scripture, you know, in the Doctrine and Covenants in the Book of Mormon, is so, you know, spiritually intense and confirmational. And when you build the foundation on that, and then you just sort of become, I don't know.
Really administrative.
Yeah.
Really.
Just follow along.
Just kind of.
Even if you don't like, know.
And God bless President Hinckley, but when you make your call at the beginning of your presidency to press, you know, just to do keep on rolling
press
along. What
forward.
Was it? What was the.
I can't remember the exact phrase, but.
Anyway. Yeah, nothing's really changing. Mm-hmm.
Okay, the next
Wait. There was a story I just wanted to mention because it bothered me. And it was about President Monson heeding the whisperings of the spirit when he went to visit, I can't remember where.
The little girl.
Someplace
he went to go visit this little sick girl.
Right. The little sick, she was dying of cancer, literally.
Yeah, right.
And her dying wish was to be able to see President Monson, to have a visit from him. And he's there on church business, and the mother talks to him and says, you know, this is really important. And he's like, blah, 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 I'll go on with my meetings. And then, you know, the spirit has to tell him, you should really go visit that little girl. Like, who wouldn't go visit a sick, dying 10-year-old girl who really wanted your visit?
Ouch.
Who wouldn't? Does it really take the spirit?
Well, if you believe your entire life and everything you do is guided by the spirit, then you're probably going to listen to that over a woman who doesn't even have the priesthood, maybe.
I don't know.
Well, when you think everything you do is guided by the spirit, then everything you do is guided by the spirit, and you don't make compassionate choices on your own, I guess. I don't know.
And we'll get to that point here in a minute with Elder Bednar. Go ahead.
Can I add one more thing? When I hear talks like this, and also Bednar's talks, I often wonder who exactly they're aimed at. Because if you look at them on the face of it, it sounds like he's talking to the one, you know, the lost sheep who's struggling and trying to make his way back. But I listened to this radio show called Out of Mormonism on a Christian talk station. And every time I listen to it, it's more and more confirmed for me that that show is not aimed at Mormons in the Valley, but it's aimed at the Christians who are a part of the church that is trying to get people out of Mormonism, because it kind of reinforces for them what they think about Mormonism and about people's struggle of getting out and coming to the real Christ. And so I wonder if talks like this, while they seem to be aimed at people who are struggling, they're actually aimed at reassuring people who truly do believe and for whom Mormonism really works. Like, don't worry about these people who are falling away. They're just standing on the side of the road to Damascus. They're not, you know, picking up putting their shoulder to the wheel and getting on with life the way they're supposed to and trusting in the Lord the way they're supposed to. So I kind of wonder if that's the true intent of talks like this. And that's a really cynical point of view, but sometimes I do wonder that.
I agree. I think the evidence is clear. They don't really deal with difficult issues. They more deal with trying to get people to avoid getting to difficult issues in the first place. You know, there'll be an admonition to avoid, you know, avoid interacting with the world. Don't go see challenging movies.
Turn
don't
down
read
the
books.
Noise.
Turn down the noise.
Put yourself in a bubble.
Exactly. But you won't hear them try to explain away, you know, Joseph Smith's morality or anything, because they don't want you to go there. They're going to edit that out of the manuals.
Well, I also think that these people, this is not their first calling in the church. You know what I mean? They've had other leadership callings, and they probably know that when people get to the point that, say, I'm at, there's no turning back. You know what I mean? There's no unringing that bell. So they're trying to get people to not get to that point.
Oh, for sure.
Right.
Yeah, definitely.
He also admonished everybody to text message the world about their faith.
I just and blog.
Tweet it.
You should tweet it.
And blog. Use the technologies to share the gospel.
As long as it's, you know, faith promoting.
The Holy Ghost could carry that.
Okay, our next speaker was Paul Johnson of the 70, and he basically talked about trials to test us, and he gave a classic model for staying in any organization, which is you can't see the outcome until the end. Of course, you don't know the end until you're dead. Mm-hmm. So once again, the methods imposed by the church don't have to have any positive outcome or any benefit, because you'll never be able to see them.
Just endure.
The one thing that just really struck me on his was the degree to which his entire model depends on whatever the challenge is coming to an end and being like, oh, wow, I'm so blessed now. Like, if you're in a sucky situation and then the sucky situation ends and nothing great happens, then Elder Johnson's talk runs into a real problem.
Or if you stay in the sucky situation, if you've got a terminal illness,
yeah.
I mean, how are you ever going to come out of that and say, "Oh, wow,
that really
helped me and developed me as a person"? No, you're dead.
Yeah, no, his talk only addresses suffering in as much as it is functionally useful,
right.
But all of the useless suffering in the world is. Well, it just doesn't exist.
Now, I'll agree with the basic premise that suffering can make us better people, But and that oftentimes we go through things that are tribulative and we come out ahead. But the problem I have with this is this as a proof of the church can be applied to absolutely anything. If you say, well, the outcome does not have to be directly related,
right,
and you won't see the outcome anyway. I mean, like, what religion or philosophy or multi-level marketing scheme or whatever does this particular talk not promote?
And he said, we'll all have just the right amount of trials for our needs.
I think that's so trite. That's one of those trite things, like the Lord will never give you more than you can
bear. Right. And what about all the people who end up in suicide because it's way more than they can handle?
Or what about if you get run over by a train?
That's what you needed.
I don't know. Maybe he's right. Mostly I think we're being a little bit hard on the poor guy. The talk was just,
it was pretty standard stuff.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to take the positive approach to looking at this talk, there are studies that suggest that people who have faith and people who believe in an afterlife or a loving God do tend to fare better in their struggles. You know what I mean? They tend to be more positive and be less despairing.
A little delusion goes a long way. It actually helps.
I mean, of course.
You can read about this.
If you believe that you're going to benefit from it, then you probably will.
This is what every government tries to strive for their people, no matter how despotic you are. If the people believe that their reward comes in the afterlife, then they don't fight for their reward or they don't fight for justice now. It's just a truism, and that's why religion is the opiate of the people, right?
But one thing he said was you don't get stronger by just taking the easy road. I mean, there are things, and I don't believe that like God is going to put difficult situations on you to make you stronger. But I think that people should go out there and do difficult things that are beneficial.
I'm kind of still waiting to be shown the easy road of life that I can just take as well. If that's one of the choices,
right,
I at least want to know about it.
Yeah. Well,
don't you know that leaving the church is the easy road? Haven't you been told that?
Yes, actually.
Certainly the easiest thing I've ever done.
Yeah. All right. David Burton, presiding bishop, was next in line. And this talk was a mixed bag for me, as is everything David Burton says. The guy sort of creeps me out a little bit. But, and he actually gave a quote which I think speaks to the creepiness. He was talking about David O. McKay, who was on his mission and was handing out tract. And this woman, by David O. McKay's story, acknowledges was starving, And he hands her the tract and he says, she says something to the effect of, how much bread can this buy me?
Bread, yeah.
Yeah.
And then David O. McKay has an epiphany at the point, realizing, hungry people aren't going to be interested in the gospel or listening to any kind of sales pitch, which is true. But David O. McKay uses the phrase bitterness in her heart at the same time that he is acknowledging that she is starving most basic level. And, it's sort of like we can't in the church still separate the idea that it's reasonable to not believe in the church or reasonable to not listen to it. They still have to like blame the victim all the time. Here's a woman in the depression, starving to death, and she has bitterness in her heart. Not that she's just got she's just hungry.
Yeah, her poverty hadn't brought her to humility, so she was bitter.
But the central irony is in this thing, McKay understands that that's the reason she's not willing to listen to him, but he still won't let it go. She still has to have bitterness.
Well, and he kind of, according to President Burton, he kind of gloms onto it as like a aha moment to say, hey, if we take care of this, then they will be prepared for the message. That's the segue, right?
Right, which is the other problem I have with the talk. Laced throughout, he would go and talk about all these great things, but laced throughout that is this sort of underhanded, we are doing this whole thing not because we want to feed the poor, but because we have this goal.
But they may actually feel like, somebody may feel like, I think you could make a legitimate case to say, even if I wouldn't agree with it, that maybe Jesus wants it that way, that he says, yeah, go feed the poor so that they'll be willing to listen to me. Set your light on a hill feed the poor so that people will be like, man, I like those people.
That's definitely the LDS reading. I think you're 100% right. Everything the church does, every time, you know, they give stuff to Japan, every time they wear Mormon Helping Hands shirts.
Or you're kind to your neighbor.
It is always about the... It's always about the press notoriety. Mm-hmm. That being said, the press notoriety is because they want people to join the church.
Sure.
Because they believe that's the only way to, for salvation. But it's never this clean sort of feed the poor because the poor are hungry. It's, and Burton said a couple things several times where he went back to that sort of theme where it's just, And I'm no Christian expert, but to my reading of the New Testament, I don't think they're getting it quite right.
Well, see, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking that actually is a problem in the New Testament. You have contradictory commandments. One is to set your light on a hill. One is to not put your candle under a basket. And the other is to not let your left hand see what your right hand is doing. So which one people.
And pray in a
closet. One of the problems that I have. Yeah. One of the problems you have is that you have to choose which doctrines you want to believe. And those are both very much in the New Testament, both very much from Jesus's mouth, you know? But I kind of empathize with yours better, but.
Well, another thing he said that I had never heard before was that, and I can't remember who said it, but it was during the, Depression, during World War II, and the church leader in conference said that they would close their seminaries, shut down their missionary service, and even the temples if they had to, but they would not let any of their people go hungry.
As long as the church has resources, we will not let you go hungry or without clothing or without shelter.
So that's a good thing, right?
That's a pretty strong statement.
Right. Yeah, if they actually would do it.
Wonders if it is, that gets into another problematic conversation about utilization of resources.
Yeah. There's only
a
other
difficult thing.
One other thing that I need to criticize in here. I'm being really negative. I apologize. I'm being really negative about this session.
I'm going to give him a positive shot in his butt.
I mostly like this talk.
The other problem is self-reliance. Okay. The church should know better than anybody that not every person out there, probably not even a majority of people, can achieve self-reliance, which is why they have the church in the first place.
Self-reliance is antithetical to the gospel.
So to keep banging that drum of self-reliance, the thought came to my mind, if you guys are so big on self-reliance, why don't you become self-reliant church? Because, they'll be happy to gild three new temples, but it's going to be on the back of non-self-reliance on the church's part. If a member has everything in order and needs this one little thing, needs to result around community, they sort of hammer that we don't want you to be, we want you to be self-reliant on this aspect, but on these other ones, you have to depend on us.
That's actually a really problematic position anyway, because self-reliance is not a Christian concept. Like, the whole concept of Christianity is to be reliant on the Lord. Mm-hmm. And so self-reliance is just the Protestant work ethic, is just an American, like our cultural Protestant concept dressed up as religion. I'm American too. I kind of like it, but it's not Christian. I mean, it is not, you cannot find in the scriptures something that talks about self-reliance. It is strictly a modern invention.
I think it's a good idea, right?
No, thrift, right. Well, avoid, I mean, I don't debt, think that everything that's good in the scriptures is there.
For disasters. I mean, to a certain extent, those are wise counsels.
Christianity is largely socialist. I mean, let's just call a spade. So I'm not saying I don't like self-reliance. It's just not in the scriptures.
But I mean, that's this interesting sort of mind screw position that the church is in today, which is, you know, we believe in welfare as a church and we believe in service, but don't you take any of it. You know, you're supposed to be self. Right. So if you are, you're less of a member. So yeah, we will have these stores, but they're not to be used.
Right.
And so it puts people in this bind where, and I've seen it over and over again culturally where, you know, we in church, we sort of love going to the welfare farm and love going to the cannery, but we really look down on anybody who uses it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
We want it there, but the people who use it there, they're not, because you're not obeying the prophet's call to
be self-reliant.
You know, you can the beans. That's great. That's what Jesus wants to do. But to actually have anybody use the beans, nope.
What did you guys think about the story that he told? And he cried during it, where there was a baby born. It was a cold it was really cold, and they, it was a very poor family. And this priesthood leader took his shirt off.
I was on
the
plains. Yeah, it was like the Martin Handcart Company.
It was that old?
Yeah.
Oh, I missed that.
It was one of the rescuers.
Brigham Young sent him out to rescue them.
He took his shirt off his back to wrap the newborn infant in who was freezing. And that was innovative. He called it innovative, welfare charity. But how, again.
Did the words innovative?
Yes,
did innovative
said innovative.
Came out of his mouth?
Yes.
Wow.
And I wonder how he can think that, like, no. Who wouldn't give their shirt for a freezing newborn baby? Who wouldn't? Again.
You see, how but is you're this? A woman. You.
Oh, come on.
You understand the
concept. Nobody's going to stand there and watch a baby freeze.
So, can I defend the church a little bit on
yes,
this
sure.
one?
Sure. Oh, please.
I can understand the church's pushed to suggest people be self-reliant because of watching people that even I know be chronically in need because of their own poor choices. And so while I agree that there is kind of a dichotomy between saying we're a Christian association that's here to help people in need and then kind of smacking your hand if you need it, that's kind of or at least, you know, it shouldn't be that way. If somebody genuinely has a need, they should be able to have it filled without shame. But I can also see a huge problem with the church in people who are bilking the system. And so they probably feel a constant need to address that. Say, hey, people, get off your butts and go work and provide for yourself. We need to build a mall.
I'm going to go with you on that, but I'm going to say that King Benjamin would never go with you on that. And that King Benjamin would.
Neither would Jesus.
King Benjamin, in his discourse, gets really upset at the idea of judging anybody who may be bilking the system. He's like, no, you don't think about that at all. They are allowed to bilk the system if they want. You just give.
Well, because you don't, you never know what's really going on. You don't know. I mean, it might look like they're bilking the system. They just might not have any coping mechanisms
whatsoever.
At all.
Well, that was my point from before. There's a certain percentage of the population that just can't cope with whatever situation that they're in for various reasons. Yeah. Lack of IQ, lack of opportunity early in their life.
Psychological disorders.
And hell's bells, maybe they're just lazy. But that doesn't mean that I would think as a Christian society, I don't know, we want those people just to starve.
I think just lazy, even saying that, I think people aren't just lazy. I think there's reasons why people don't do things. And it's more psychologically difficult than we give
this
it credit for.
This gets into this gigantic discussion of meritocracy, which I think is endlessly fascinating, but highly problematic. I mean, it's highly problematic to sort of.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think we could spend hours talking about, you know, circumstances that basically force out a certain percentage of the population that won't be able to achieve to the minimum level of achievement.
Right.
But I think
it does take a lot to be successful in our society.
So this is that too. You know, my point is that it's two-fisted. The church, on the one hand, seems to understand that and, you know, builds up these great welfare delivery systems that are really, really good. On the other hand, seems to be a lot of blame the victim sort of stuff going on.
But it's good that they provide that service nevertheless.
Okay. Sylvia Allred, first counselor in the Relief Society. Man, she doesn't look like an Allred.
the only female speaker for this session, right?
Yeah.
It was a short talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
kind of trite.
And it was really kind of a continuation of Elder Bednar's talk in almost everything.
Yep. Love one another, serve one another, welfare. Bishop's in charge, but the women are the heart of welfare. That's about it.
Once again, I'm going to go negative again, so I'm sorry. But, the talk was good, but it just breaks my heart every time to see these poor women who get dragged up and have to kowtow to the brethren over and over again. They always have to say, under the direction of the priesthood. You know, the Relief Society can never be acknowledged for doing anything without saying first that the priesthood authorized or the priesthood directed it or whatever.
Yeah.
I the only thing that I really got from her talk that I wrote down was when people do everything they can and still can't make ends meet, then the church stands ready to help, which is what you were talking about before. Boy, you better be on the brink of, you better be on the just, you're disastered. You know, your credit cards are maxed. Your home equity line of credit is done. You haven't paid your mortgage for months or whatever. Then you,
give you some beans and rice.
It wouldn't be so hypocritical if the church itself was like that. If the church said, and you can go to other churches to do this, say, this is our operational budget for the year. This is how much we were able to get through our these various things. This is what we're short. The church
most
doesn't follow these rules to them.
Do that.
Yeah, but the church doesn't follow rules to themselves. They want 10%, even if they're swimming in dough.
And so, even if you don't have any food in your cupboards.
Absolutely. They'll get up and say, pay it first, even if you don't have enough to pay your bills.
Because it's faith.
But you know, so they want the check carte blanche, but they don't give it to anybody else. All right, let's move on to...
Hey, I have one more thing to say, sorry. The one thing that stood out to me, and I might have misheard her, but she said something about the role of the Relief Society has not changed, and that is because it's divinely inspired. But I think it has changed, because from reading Mormon Enigma, it sounds like the Relief Society was also supposed to be a temperance society in which they called people on the carpet in public to criticize their behavior.
Their morality.
Yeah. And they were, you know, that watchful eye, making sure everybody was behaving as they were supposed to do. And I don't believe the Relief Society does that anymore.
It was like Big Sister.
Yeah.
Right. And for a while, there was no Relief Society. And I always, you know, just kind of scratched that 20 years out of the record.
Well, the history of the Relief Society is fascinating, and most people don't. It's not what you would expect at all. Yeah. All right. Elder Bednar of the 12, he sort of continued with the theme, like we mentioned before. He talked about this, you know, experience with light. He gave the metaphor of light as sort of arriving at metaphysical knowledge through revelation or whatever, and talked about sort of a slow breaking light, like the... like the sun rising in the cloudy day,
in the hazy day,
and also the flipping on the light in the dark room were his two
dichotomies.
Yeah,
I had a bit of an epiphany while I was listening to his talk. I was glad to have an epiphany while I was listening to the conference, and part of that was that
the light switch.
That was exactly how my apostasy worked. That there was this dawning realization over a long period of time of like, this, none of this works. I don't know. I can't make any of this work. And reading the scriptures and really coming to just brick walls, you know, anytime you pick you. And also that feeling of the light coming on, this like, okay, I'm going to actually say to myself consciously, what if it's not true, and start thinking through that. And the degree to which it felt like the lights just went on in the universe in a really strong way. And that was a little confusing at the time, but, I'll vouch for Elder Bednar's methodology of learning truth from that standpoint.
Right.
Yeah, you know, he talks about, and the whole middle part of his speech was all about basically, if you haven't had any revelation, stick with the program
anyway.
Don't worry
about it.
Well, and it's also your fault.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's the don't wait on the road to Damascus talk.
Yeah, I like that it's not your fault, because at one point he says that addiction and harmful substances impede our ability to receive revelation. And this is one of those things, like I was saying earlier, it's just so statement that they put out there. How, under what circumstance they say, why in the world would it be that you can't receive revelation if you're, say, addicted to alcohol? Because aren't we all, every human being,
imperfect,
have something of that like, right, whether it be food or cupcakes or alcohol or pornography or Sunday football or crocheting, or yelling
that distracts
at your kids.
Your mind
at what
from
point
heavenly
does the Lord give us some mercy and
visions,
say, like, I understand that you have weaknesses. Let me help
that's
you with those things.
This idea, you can take this small laundry list and say this, you know, we pointed out over and over again that the church says you can't drink whiskey. But there's all these other things that people do that are unhealthy in the church, right, that are just as unhealthy to their bodies.
Or maybe not even unhealthy, but definitely distracting from like heavenly purposes.
Absolutely. Like and then to say, these six here, we will tell you as a church authorities, you cannot have heaven talk to you if you're doing these. Yeah. This hubris and arrogance that is not balanced anywhere in like traditional scripture, nor is there anything in Mormon doctrine to, you read the section 89, and nowhere does it say, you know, it says this is for your health and well-being. It doesn't say like, God won't talk to you, by the way, if you have some tobacco.
I thought what really kind of killed me about his talk was that he started off with this conceit that I'm going to talk to you about the two different ways you can really learn from the spirit. And he goes through and as he's kind of coming to the culmination of it, he's talking about dreams. He says, you can get dreams, you can get visions, you can have conversations with angels, and you can have inspiration. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, those are all, I would love to have dreams and visions and conversations with angels. I have a little bit of experience with inspiration, maybe. And then he, after he's sort of built up these two methodologies of learning truth, he says, but this one that is three quarters of the examples I just gave, dreams rarely and visions happens. And conversations with angels, you should be highly suspect of anybody who
right. Who and in fact, they're probably not in good standing with the church.
They're not in good. If a Paul comes to you and says,
I had a vision
that the church that I belong to is in apostasy, because that's what Paul's vision said, you should be highly suspect of that. You shouldn't be paying attention to that. Really, you want to stick to the dawn breaking that you can't really tell. That's a subtle influence promptings. Over a long time.
Yeah, and that leads into what I think is the most important thing in his talk, which I will call the Cowdery paradox. So he talks about Oliver Cowdery at the end of the talk.
TM.
And
the Cowdery paradox, TM.
he talks about how Cowdery was doing this stuff and that Oliver Cowdery was unable to recognize that he was receiving revelation.
Joseph had to tell him.
Joseph had to tell him that you were actually receiving revelation. Now, the Cowdery paradox continues to this day with the brethren. If people in church authority are unable to tell when they're receiving revelation, they are also unable to tell when they're not receiving revelation. So given his whole speech here, he ends with this Cowdery paradox that the brethren and high individuals, if they can walk in the light and not recognize it, as Bednar's words use, it is also possible to do the opposite, to walk in the darkness and think you are in the light.
Well, yeah.
So the entire premise of Bednar's talk here is undermined by him by himself because he has no rubric, he has no tool for telling when mm-hmm. he's actually having revelation and when he's not, because he himself says that they're indistinguishable by people like Cowdery.
Plus, it's just so... A few years ago, we had this nice guy in our ward get up in fast and testimony meeting, and he expressed some doubt. And he said, you know, I really hope, I kind of believe, I don't remember exactly, you know, and I probably wasn't paying that much attention. I was probably smacking my kids or something. But then we went into priesthood meeting, and the high priest group leader got up and said, I just want to tell you, brother, I know that you know. You don't doubt. I know that you know. And I'm like, and I was... I wanted to put my arm around the other guy and be like, I don't know if you know. I'll stand by you on that. Like, why?
Yeah, why would that other guy be so patronizing and say, you know?
But,
you know.
Have you noticed that in the church, it's become the knowing. It's not about what you know. Right. It's not about what it is that you know. It's just
or
this
constant
it's just that you know.
Drumming that you know. I know the church is true.
The prophet is really the Lord's spokesman.
But even when we start putting even suppositions like that, they have big words. I know the church is true. What's the church? What's true? What does that mean?
Yeah, what is true?
It's just knowledge of what. It doesn't really matter. You just have to know and then know that the brethren are there. So I don't understand how Bednar didn't see that big logical flaw in his reasoning.
Yeah, and 6 months ago to the day, we have that big logical flaw in his reasoning as you have the president of the Quorum of the Twelve get up and give his inspired message, which, come to find out a few days later, is not doctrinal, needs to be switched, needs to be fixed.
Right.
And so here's my challenge to all the faithful listeners out there who want to save my soul. Please tell me, if the brethren, if the prophets of God cannot recognize the difference between revelation and non-revelation, how in the hell are any of the rest of us supposed to?
Yes. That was a bit of a breaking point for me.
I think the faithful would say that it coincides with the Lord's general plan. You know what I mean? That
you mean
like
the general plan to keep the blacks out of the temple, like that sort of thing?
Or like President
I'm trying
Packer.
To take the faithful stance
President
here,
Packer
John.
Going backwards on the church's position on homosexuality really clearly. Like, I mean, he just tossed out like 10 or 15 years of progress and then it got tossed back in and you go, okay, that's a real problematic thing.
But another thing that Bednar says is that Joseph Smith, the fundamental truths of the restored gospel were not revealed all at once to him, but rather as the circumstances dictated and when the time
was
right. So, I mean, even if the leader of the dispensation who was supposed to restore all the truth didn't get all the truth and it's still like coming trickling in, it doesn't really make sense to me.
Well, and we don't really, I mean, and you wouldn't want to start to dig into what those kinds of things were, like, say, polygamy, the true nature of the Godhead
Adam
from
God.
1820 to 1838, either, you know,
right.
I mean, or yeah, and then, you know, go from the true nature of the Godhead to Adam God for the next 40 years after that, you know, I mean, like,
right. It just
that
changes.
Sort of trickling is a, that's not a very
fundamental truths of the gospel. Are
flip-flopped. Yeah.
Okay, the last talk was by President Monson, and his talk was on temples and trying to encourage members to get out to the temples. And he, you know, he led with some, you know, sort of heartbreaking stories about how people saved for years in order to make it to the temple, and temples were very far away and arduous and difficult to get to.
All right, their families for 4 years.
Once again, I need to remind the church brethren of their own history. It doesn't have to be this way. When the saints came out to Utah, there were no temples. There were no temples for a long time, so they built the endowment house. It wasn't a temple, and they did endowments at it. When the Edmunds Tucker Act was imposed, and all the church authorities were on the run, they did ceilings, the marriages, wherever the hell they wanted to. They did it in people's basements, they did them wherever.
In
they
fields, don't, on mountains.
You don't have to have a temple to do temple ordinances. We know that from the church history. So here's what you do. You take every stake center and you take a room and you go and set apart that room as the endowment room.
Show the video.
Luckily, we've already got a video. So we don't have to train
it's
any
easy
live
to transmit.
Actors. And then you can have all of the membership of the church blessed with the blessings of having a temple. You don't have to have people work in the salt mines for 5 friggin' years to save enough money to fly to New Zealand. You don't have to do that. That's a self-imposed thing by the church.
Right.
You don't have to make people suffer that way.
That is not the thing that I thought of, but I think that that's a really interesting. What I did think of is we get teary-eyed about these stories of sacrifice, and we're like, man, that's really faith-promoting, and I'm really... And
it's sad.
And we're actually cutting our own faith promoting legs out from under us by building a temple in everybody's backyard, because I don't have to sacrifice to go to the temple, and almost nobody does anymore. The saints in Italy, as they don't have to go all the way up to Switzerland anymore, they're just like, well, it's a couple of hours away, so I don't really go anymore. And like I'm going, this lack of sacrifice, you're like, man, sacrifice is fantastic. Sacrifice makes you strong. Well, all of this actually just takes away the need to sacrifice, and you don't have those faith-promoting stories anymore.
That's good, because I think it's ridiculous
for
a father to be away from his 10 children for 4 years.
Well, that's the history
working in the nickel
right
mine. I mean, it's just ridiculous. What's more important, his family or, well...
Well, and
I mean, I understand that from the church's point of view, the most important thing is getting to the temple, getting sealed so that he can have his family forever. But what about now?
Well, and we don't have to have people stop sacrificing. Like, if the church didn't hang
the
all
sacrifice
those twinkly
now is to
Christmas
stop drinking
lights,
coffee. So that's a big sacrifice.
If,
yeah.
if they spent a little bit less on film production or on Christmas lights on Temple Square, how many people could they fly to the temples?
That's
if
true.
If they spent less on importing the finest mahogany and literally gilding things in the temple, you know, what could they do? It's they have the resources.
I think
you're talking
about
and
mountains
sad.
And Muhammad and moving and stuff. I think you're actually in the wrong faith tradition, John. I don't know.
Well, we just got done reading Devery Anderson's book on the history of the temple, and that there's a passage in there from the Brethren where they specifically say they early shoot down the idea of building a lot of temples because of what you just said. They said, well, our ancestors had to suffer, so we're going to make people suffer. What I'm saying is there's enough suffering in the world that's
already
just naturally imposed that you don't have to create those things.
Yeah.
That the church can still have people work in the salt mines and take that money and do something else with it rather than force them to. But I mean, there's solutions readily at hand. And this sort of stuff just gets, it's like they want, and I understand the psychology of religion. I understand that people who sacrifice heavily for something are more likely
are
to
invested.
Stay involved.
Right.
They're invested. Mm-hmm.
The sunk costs are too great to let it go.
Well, and if you just say, here's a room in the stake center that you can get your endowment in, then why did they spend so much time and so much sacrifice building the temples in the first place. Then it just kind of...
Well, that that would become a problem. But we are starting to share parking lots. I mean, that's kind of a big deal, John.
Well, they're building them smaller. Lots? And they're not...
With temples and stake centers.
Oh, come on. Well, that works.
Then they're not lighting them up like a Christmas tree as much, the smaller ones.
I think it's definitely a good idea, the small temples.
Yeah.
It should have happened a long, long time ago.
Most of the Christian and Jewish world says there should be one temple. The temple is the residing place of God. And since you only have one God, you only have one temple. So it's a symbolic resting place of God. Once you shoot that pattern down and you say, we have lots of temples, well, they have a bazillion of them. I mean, they can be made out of plywood just as well as they can be made out of granite, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the question then is, if we have so many temples, why do we only have 200? Why don't we have 1,000?
Yeah.
Why don't we build one in every stake?
Well, I think that, I mean, if you asked President Monson now, he'd say, we're going to have 1,000.
Well, good.
But they just have to be nice because the Lord likes gold and the Lord likes spiral staircases. And he has preferences. He is not a God without passion. He has preferences.
Interior design.
Yes. Well, I...
you don't
if I'm going to become like him, I have interior design preferences. So what's wrong with that?
Yep.
Heather?
Yeah, I can tell I'm newly disaffected because this is making me cringe just a tiny, tiny bit. But
cringe away. Let us know where we're off base.
I don't know. I still want to think the best of the leadership of the church, I guess. And I think the response would be that the Lord has his own time frame and his own purpose, and that we don't know what the plan is, and that if everything goes according to plan and the people who live in Happy Valley, who have access to the temples around the clock, will do what they're supposed to, at some point in eternity, everybody will be blessed by the temple.
Because the people in Happy Valley did it?
Yeah. And I realize that's, a cop-out, but I don't know. I don't quite have as much of a pessimistic outlook yet. I'm sure it's coming, though.
Well, I mean, I
don't think... Really, John, I mean, if you listen to what John is saying, he's not really being pessimistic. He's being more optimistic.
He's saying there's a pragmatic solution to this quandary of yours.
And people didn't have to suffer for 150 years.
I agree, but as to the motives of the leadership.
The motives of the leadership, I'm sure, I mean, they realize that it's not right for people to have to sacrifice 4 years of their lives working in the nickel mines to try to get to the temple.
I don't know if they realize that. I'll bet they don't. Actually, I'll bet they think
it's
fair.
He
just underlined it in conference as being a fabulous thing.
You know what?
So.
He just sees it from
a
different
perspective. So what do you think about that story?
When I was in high school and doing the womanhood recognition thing, I had this great idea that one of my projects could be raise money with a group of people, raise enough money to help send a family to the temple who's really far away from the temple. And I wasn't allowed to do it. Because according to what I was told by the stake president was that I was told that it's the stance of the church that those things should be handled by the people who want to go to the temple, not
that's
by
ridiculous.
An outside.
Wow. See, here goes to, and I don't
you
mean
just
to,
blew me right out of the water.
I don't mean to get into class warfare again. But if you listen carefully, when you hear most of the brethren come from the corridor and they share a pioneer heritage, they will use their ancestors and the sacrifice that their ancestors made to legitimize their position. But they didn't grow up under those circumstances themselves. Mm-hmm. So the sacrifice of 4 or 5 generations back legitimizes their position. But they will then put circumstances on the others in which they have to suffer, saying, well, God makes people suffer. But they fail to acknowledge that they went to schools that they didn't build.
They went to Harvard.
They didn't dig their own wells. That everything was paved for them.
Yeah.
But they used the pioneers. They used the Martin Handcart Company, of which likely none of them are descendants, to legitimize their own position. The church still owns stake camps. There are all over in Utah. There are camping grounds with cabins and lodges and all sorts of facilities that the church pays for. And if you go down, 2,500 miles to the south, there are LDS children who are starving to death. Now, if anybody believes in heaven and believes that these guys in Salt Lake are going to be the gatekeepers of that. I just can't understand that morality.
It's that Protestant work ethic creep again.
But the Protestant work ethic, it's a lie because
I agree,
because it's the work ethic of people who are long dead, and they look around and say, why in America can we build this thing up, but these morons in Africa can't? But they forget once again that they didn't pave the roads, that they didn't dig the wells. The wells were already here. You know, the sewer system was here. It's not like I went and dug that. So and that same attitude is in the church and comes out and talks like this. I'm sorry, I'm mad, but it's just complete bullshit that they can say these guys need to be in the mines to earn this thing that people can just walk down the street here to get.
Yeah, well, it's a completely inconsistent position as well. If you consider the perpetual immigration fund or the perpetual education fund, either one of which takes the idea of let's. And I think they're both relatively inspired programs. I like the Perpetual Education Fund, but why wouldn't there be a Perpetual Temple Fund? Well, here, we'll get you to the temple, exactly, and then you pay it back
and
over time.
Why
you know, like, what's
idea?
Wrong with that?
But that's still that's still playing into my point. I went to BYU.
I didn't mean to. Okay.
And the church subsidized my education by probably $30,000 or $40,000 while I was there. But if I live in Peru and want to get a cosmetology book, I have to pay that back to the church. So there's still this inside and outside. The church,
is
willing to subsidize the institutes and all this stuff here
close by.
But the others,
everybody
they're on the leash. They're on interest to pay it back.
Well, you got to make sure that they feel the need to be faithful. I don't.
Anyway.
Yeah.
There should be more Heathers.
Yeah,
in
you
the
just
world.
Blew me. Yeah, you just kind of blew me up there with my nice. I was feeling warm and fuzzy about that example. No, it's cool. I didn't really need that testimony anyway, John.
I do think
I haven't been using it well, obviously.
Oh, well, back to Monson's what Monson said though. Remember at the end of his talk, he was building up this announcement kind of thing. He was like, "What did he say?"
He said he wanted to speak about a temple in the future.
Yeah, and then he's talking about the Rome temple.
Hey, I really thought he was going to be talking about independence.
My mission in Italy. I feel strongly about the Rome Temple, sort of.
It's great, but
there's no baptisms in Italy. But you know,
especially with the look that he got on his face, I thought, I thought this is going to be a moment of actual revelation,
right? Something new,
yeah. And I really thought he was going to say the Temple and Independence, but
so if you have a temple in the seat of Catholicism, you've done something.
And then why? Yeah. Okay,
and he said it was a temple. I thought he said it was a temple that was built 2,500 years ago.
A city 2,500 years old.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I thought he was going to talk about Jerusalem at that point.
Yeah, I thought something more exciting, but hey.
I was kind of tuned out by then.
So we better wrap up. We've gone long. I do want to say this. I do not think that I think the brethren think that they're good guys. I do not think that they have like evil intent. I just want to point out, as I did a couple times, that they have some really bad assumptions that they're building their logic on. So I don't think that they're like, ooh, yeah, we're gonna get them or. But I do think they need to look a little bit more careful at their presuppositions, and I think that's where they're going wrong. Not that they have some sort of ill intent. I think when they're building temples, when they're building the welfare program, when they're talking about faith, they have the noblest of intent. But
their whole vision is skewed because they're surrounded by people who just say yes, President.
All right, any you guys aren't as far gone. Any bring it up.
I don't know that I can. You know when you're, or maybe you had this experience when you were a believer, when you had a position that you knew was true and the other person was just like slamming you over the head with the real answer and you were like, yeah, but that's kind of how I feel at the moment. So that's all I can leave you with.
I'm sorry. Conference always gets me a little annoying.
Yeah.
I thought
this session wasn't too hard to listen to, though.
This session, it wasn't too hard to listen to, but it was a real good example of why I know that I cannot go to church right now and be like detached, because I was, wife was like, oh, calm down.
Yeah, and you start nitpicking every little thing. Like,
invalidated Paul as a member of the church. Like, you just said, if Paul was today, you would want to distance yourself from him because that he would be a sign that he wouldn't be good.
Or Joseph Smith or you know,
or anybody.
The first 100 years of the church. Yeah, yeah.
And absolutely. It wouldn't really matter what they said. I would probably find something to nitpick about it. So I apologize
for
that.
I'm not going to apologize, but I maybe my delivery could have been better. All right. Well, Heather, Greg, Zilpa, thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Hello and welcome to the last and final Sunday PM session of General Conference for Mormon Expression. I'm your host, back again, Tom, and I'm joined by an illustrious panel, illustrious or just fantastic. You choose your adjective. I've got one of our regulars who's here and there, but love to have him back. Jim, what's up, Jim?
Doing well. Good to be back. Been busy with work, but always glad to give my voice.
Glad to have you, man. Glad to have you. And we also have who's been on the Mormon Expression before, John B. What's up, John?
Hello. Doing great. And just so everyone knows, I post as Cinepro on a couple forums. So that's who I am.
Including the Mad Boards, is that right?
Yeah.
So one of the few left. And we also have a female to bring in some of the ladies. We've got Audrey, who's new to Mormon Expression. Welcome, Audrey.
Yeah. Well, oh, thank you. I'm very happy to be here. Very excited.
Excellent. Great to have you. All right. So Sunday PM session usually gets overlooked, which is a shame. We paid attention this time. It was presided by and conducted by President Henry B. Eyring. Nothing special there. Let's start with first speaker, Elder Richard G. Scott. He talked about a lot about his wife and his own personal life. Talked about he got married in the Manti Temple. And one of the things that is kind of a reigning theme is that he said to the young men, don't waste your life and get married. Get out there and date.
Yeah, between this and President Monson yesterday, I am so glad I am married.
You don't need that kind of guild anymore, huh?
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
Well, you have to figure out how to produce revenue somehow.
Oh, yeah. Come on with the agenda already.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I'm honestly not sure why that seems to be the reigning theme this conference, because even in the Saturday afternoon, there was one or two speakers that mentioned quit lazing around, you guys, and get married.
Yeah. And I remember, 20 years ago, they made a comment about men who were delaying marriage so they could accumulate property and something to that effect. But I have to wonder, what do things look like to them church-wide for it to be such a concern?
I mean, yeah.
Is there an epidemic of eligible young men just choosing not to get married?
There might be, but I don't know. Audrey, are all the women just turning them down flat? What is it?
Or maybe the women aren't turning them down, if you know what I mean.
Maybe.
I think the church is following the general trends of society, and men and women are both getting married later.
Or not at all, right? I guess there is probably a small minority that
aren't. Sometimes not at all.
Well, I think that, if you do get married young, it sets you on, the proper Mormon path. The longer you wait, the more, I guess, to use the church terminology, the more worldly you become, and the sooner you get married, the sooner you get on that path, the more kids you have, the more, potential callings that you can acquire, it's a path of progression that they want to set them on in an earlier stage in life.
Could be. When Elder Scott says, he said this one line, I wrote it down. He says, it is so rewarding to be married. Reemphasizing how awesome it is, and marriage overcomes tendencies to be selfish. I feel really sorry for those men. And sorry for the women that haven't had the opportunity to marry too.
Oh, he weeps for the women.
Almost forgot him, but you got him in there.
Yeah. Well, and I think, honestly, if the no sex before marriage isn't doing the trick, then I don't know what else you can do to encourage a young man to get married. I mean, it's like, what greater motivation can there be?
Well, and they mentioned that, yeah, too. And they said, well, the longer you wait to get married, the more chance of, you know, sin, you know, crops up, too.
Yeah.
Well, we are living in times that economically are very uncertain. And for young people to want to take control of their destinies financially, educationally, is really pretty wise. And I find it hard to, well, I know my own daughters, it used to be they wanted to get married the same age mom did, which was actually 24. So I didn't get married to BYU or anything like that. But now we're up to about 26, because one wants to go to professional school. And there's this feeling that they need to take as much control of that as they can, because a lot of it is beyond their control. And that's, I don't think that's unreasonable.
To some degree, my view into the plight of the single Mormon men comes through some relatives I have that are, you know, past the age of 25 and are still single. And from what I've seen, you know, they're not passing up opportunities. They're not intentionally delaying it. They just honestly don't feel like they've met the right person.
Yeah.
And I did feel like Elder Scott's talk hinted at the idea of maybe they're a little too picky. Maybe their standards are a little too high. You know, I know that the people I know have met people that you know, they were almost there, but they just couldn't seal the deal. And, you know, thinking there might be someone better, or there was just one concern. And, you know, maybe that's part of the problem. Maybe they just need to, you know, find someone who, and the women that they had been talking to had more than once kind of said, well, you know, if you're almost there and you're living the gospel, that can be enough. You know, they kind of made that pitch.
Yeah.
And so I wonder, you know, if that's part of the problem.
I just don't understand the emphasis. As I mentioned earlier on the Saturday afternoon session, when they mentioned this as well, there's plenty of single people out there in the church. Why the constant pressure of guilt to get married, especially if they always throw that caveat that, hey, you know what, if you live your life single and you never get the opportunity to get married, there will be a spouse provided to you in the afterlife. Fine, roll with that. Why the constant pressure? You've got to get it done. You've got to get it done now. Quit wasting your time. Why not just let the single people in the church be happy for a change? Sheesh.
Because single people don't form families.
And that's
single people,
but they will in the next life.
Don't pay tithing,
but we need them now. Right. We need them here.
Okay,
we need children in our primaries.
Yeah, all right, that's fair. I guess I just don't understand the double standard.
I think the church should leverage their experience online and come up with an official LDS.org/dating. You know, and they should come up with their own dating site.
There's so many other spin-offs. Yeah,
a dating site for LDS people.
Officially from the only church, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, but it'd only take one pedophile to ruin that, wouldn't it? All right.
Hey, we're going to leave Joseph Smith out of this discussion.
Oh, my gosh.
I just want to say that I did think Elder Scott's talk was very sweet, and my eyes were moist several times. I thought it was he obviously loved his wife very much, and he just wanted to see everyone else have that kind of an experience. Okay. I think it's a little unrealistic that sometimes I get the feeling that when we hear talks about marriage, as long as people are living doing everything they're supposed to in the church, their marriage is going to be incredible. And that's unrealistic. And I think it really, unfortunately, when people realize that, then there's a real big come down.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. He was choked up through most of it. He does sound like he loves his wife.
Scott never remarried, did he? I think most of the apostles that were widowers have since remarried, but Elder Scott never did.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And this point, I mean, it wasn't just, you know, this talk, but, you know, even, you know, on our mission, on my mission at least, and I'm sure on several others, that point was driven home that, you know, you get home, you go to school, and you get married right away. So, I mean, this is a continual theme, you know, that's just been repeated, you know, in this conference.
It is, but society's pushing you to marry later, and I think that's just a smarter move. And to have kids later, get your financial stability underneath your feet first, and the church has always kind of been a little bit at odds with that. But anyway, moving on. Second speaker, Elder D. Todd Christofferson, one of the newer apostles. Anyway, he starts off his talk by saying, "What? Be therefore perfect." And if you hadn't felt any guilt about anything in any of these talks up to this point, get ready. He hit this one pretty good. He says we need to practice and adopt divine chastising. We need to be willing to accept and even seek correction. Oh, yeah, this was nice. This was a nice talk of letting you know that if you haven't been chastised enough, you're not looking for it.
Yeah, this was your typical, you know, if you think you're living a good life, you're wrong. You know, you need to once again, you know, get that stick and beat yourself with it. You know, kind of a topic.
Ugh. This was my least favorite talk, and I really disliked it a lot.
Yeah, it was, I don't know, for me, I didn't like it, the whole gardener cutting down the currant bush. Listen here, bush. No.
It was interesting that a good portion of his talk was taken from other general authorities' talks, at least yes. three parts of it.
That's true, too.
I do the same thing when I have to give talks, so I don't blame him.
I Googled it. This was a recycled talk from the 1970s, New Era.
He talks about Hugh B. Brown and that he was discriminated for being a Mormon, and chastising comes down from, this was my favorite, when he says that chastising can even come down from those who are inspired from God, like your church leaders. I was like, oh, man, all right. And then, but my favorite line, I will give him one little credit, is eventually we want to become self-correcting. That I agree with. So,
and that's that. If the emphasis had been there a little bit more, it may have been more acceptable. But as it was, I felt like it was nag, nag, nag.
No, this. It's the general theme of you're not good enough, and if you think you're good enough, you're wrong.
Or be prepared to be told you're wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it seemed like it was a reaction to what, you know, he fears is complacency among some people in the church, where they feel like they're doing okay. And
you know, they need
a little motivation.
What would be wrong with that view, you know? I mean, if you're doing what, you know, the Lord's anointed have told you to do, I mean, the message seems to be clear that, you know, there's still room for improvement. You know, it's like a parent who, you know, can, or a child who can never please his parent. It's a dysfunctional relationship.
All right. Anything else about Elder D. Todd Christofferson? So we have like up to 8 speakers. Some of them are pretty short, but third speaker, Carl B. Pratt of the 70. This one, I didn't take a whole lot of notes. He just says tithing, all he asks is 10%. But the one interesting thing is it seemed like he was bringing up the long time debate of where you pay your tithing from. Because he says, we pay our tithing from our firstlings, not our abundance or excess. Pay as soon as you get your money. And I thought that he was trying, maybe indirectly or unintentionally, brought up the pay on your gross thing again.
Well, I thought he almost went beyond that when he told the story of his grandparents in Mexico. There was an element to that story of the grandparents not just taking an accounting of, because he talked about how they were on a barter system and, you know, silver coins. And he kind of described this economic situation where it wasn't just numbers on a ledger, but a community. And, you know, and in the end, his grandparents looked at all the blessings they had received and paid what they felt was an honest tithing on all of the blessings, including even intangible blessings or blessings in kind from other people. So it wasn't just, you know, their income, but their blessings. And so I thought that could open the door to some creative people feeling like, oh, you know, someone, someone did a good deed for me today, so that's a blessing, and so I need to take that into account when I pay tithing.
Yeah, I think more, you know, to that point and others, they also brought up the fact that you're not supposed to expect blessings from tithing, too.
Not material blessings.
Don't expect. Yeah, don't expect money as a blessing to come back. Yeah.
Nothing specific.
Which, you know, flies in the face of at least, you know, my experience of growing up in the church and being taught, well, you will receive, you know, tangible, you know, blessings from tithing, you know, that, you know, your checkbook will balance, you know, somehow magically if you, you know, give money for, you know, the City Creek project, for instance.
Yeah, I think he says, hey, the blessings you'll earn is learning how to live off the 90%.
Yeah, and, you know, with Elder Scott's talk earlier, I thought to myself, you know, boy, I would sure love to see the statistics on the unmarried young men in the church. And when I heard Elder Pratt's talk, I was thinking, boy, I would love to see what, you know, the economic crisis of the last couple of years has done to the church's, you know, balance sheet.
Well, not only the economic crisis, but the you know, with the internet and with, you know, more information being out there, the almost, you know, sea change in membership numbers and people fleeing the church as well. You know, I think they're getting
especially young people.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what kind of a, you know, what does it look like to, you know, the people sitting in the church office building? And, you know, is it just kind of an inconvenience or is it a crisis? You know, what's really going on with these numbers?
Good questions. I don't know.
And I don't blame them for not making them public.
Even though curious minds want to know.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you look to other countries, you know, Canada, England, you know, for instance, who do publish numbers, the actual financial situation is drastically different. I mean, I think GM probably gives more in charitable organizations than what was reported in England.
Yeah. You know. It's possible. I don't know. It's a sticky thing there. I mean, there's no way to really get a clear answer. But I will say he did quote Elder James E. Faust, a line that I kind of shook my head and I even TiVo'd back a little bit just to make sure I heard it right. He says, "The payment of tithing is insurance against divorce."
Yeah, I didn't get that.
I think it's a cause of divorce, actually. No, quite frank.
No, because so many divorces are caused by financial troubles, but if you're paying your tithing, then you'll just have less money to fight over. I will say that I watched this session of conference with a very faithful LDS associate of mine, and even they rolled their eyes at this talk, like, oh my goodness.
Really?
Enough is enough, yeah. Faithful member of the church. So
the story of with the coin, the bag of coins, and how, I mean, we all knew how that was going to end, that there were going to be 100 pesos in the bag, but shouldn't there have been 111 so they could pay tithing on that and still come out?
Yeah.
Well, and plus on the interest earned, you know, when they invested that money too.
Yeah.
I think the ultimate problem is that obviously the church is locked into a 10% number, so they've just got to find a way to get more people to pay more money somehow.
Yeah. Well, that's where the marriage comes in.
Yeah.
All right. So here's we're coming up to my second favorite talk of the session, the fourth speaker, Lynn G. Robbins of the 70. To be or not to be, that is a very good question.
Oh my God.
And this is my favorite part. And I couldn't help myself, and I wanted to, like you, John B., I wanted to watch this and listen to this with kind of a better open mind. I didn't have anybody there that I could kind of feed off of from a faithful perspective necessarily, but I wanted to be positive. But this one, I ended up laughing out loud. My wife's like, knock it off. I don't know what you're laughing at, but that doesn't seem appropriate. But he kept doing the be and the do. So it ended up kind of being a dooby-dooby-dooby-dooby-doo thing. And he kept using his hands. You know, his right hand was the be, and his left hand was the do. And I kept thinking, wax on, wax off. And every time he was doing it, I kept thinking, this would be the perfect drinking game. Jägermeister for the left hand.
And the thing is to be or not to be is, you know, the character's asking whether he's going to commit suicide or not, you know, and then he relates it to something totally unrelated to the Shakespeare quote, you know, unless I misinterpret Hamlet. So,
I mean, ultimately, I think the message of the talk was really good. It was, you know, kind of like, you know, if Stephen R. Covey was speaking in conference, I would expect to hear something like this. And, you know, I think if you just look at the principles of what he was talking about, it's very positive. And, you know,
I kept getting lost every time he was moving his hands. I just like, where's he going? Oh, do, is that the do part or the be part? I don't know. Too distracting.
Well,
sorry.
I thought it started out awfully harsh, and it did. Then it got into talking about parenting and ways to be a Christ-like parent or teach your children. I thought it was very good. But at the beginning, it was terribly harsh, I thought, when he basically said that to do without being is hypocrisy. And I think that really grabbed my attention because just this week, I, as Relief Society president, I went to a member's home that was not a pleasant place to be. It didn't smell very nice, and it wasn't a very enjoyable visit, but I was doing what needed to be done. And as I left, I was thinking, is it okay if I don't enjoy this? And according to Elder Roberts, Robbins, it's not. And that, I mean, that's how it felt to me. Like, well, you not only do you have to do this, but you should enjoy doing it. And I didn't enjoy it, but I did it anyway. And to me, love is an action verb. And that's it's the doing that's important. It might not be in my heart that I'm enjoying it, but I'm doing it. And so, I mean, I felt like this kind of totally wiped that out on me.
Yeah. I mean, the message of his talk, you know, he talked about focusing on character, not achievements, you know, all this, but for the most part, the church really does focus on what we do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not what we, you know, are, what our character is. It's, you know, are you doing this? Are you doing your home teaching? Are you paying your tithing? All this. It's, there's no separation between what you do and what you be.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, it's like you don't go into a temple recommend interview and just have them ask you, you know, about your character. It's like, no, what are you doing? And so it just seemed kind of odd for a talk to distinguish between the two. When, as far as I can tell, God doesn't. So,
anyway. Yeah, and for those of you that haven't watched this talk, go back, watch it, and tell me if you guys don't get distracted by his hand moving.
Well, we will now.
All right, fifth speaker, Benjamin D. Hoyos of the 70. This guy had a really thick accent, really thick accent.
Yeah, he was hard to understand sometimes.
Yeah, he was like... what's her face on Modern Family, where you get the baby cheeses and the baby cheeses.
Exactly.
Anyway.
the two lines that he said that I wrote down is, he says, someone asks him, why your church have such a long name? Well, because the Savior gave it to us like that.
Oh, I hope he never looks that up on Wikipedia.
Wikipedia. And I only wrote this down, and it's not as a slant, or I'm not making fun of him or anything like that. Please take that into consideration before I say this, when he says the Lord wants us to be wishionaries. Anyway, any thoughts from you guys?
I love that. I'm going to use that. Don't be a wishionary, exactly. Be a missionary. All right.
Well, I thought that his emphasis on saints, Latter-day Saints, and what a saint does was very church-oriented kind of sainthood, whereas I thought that the talk before had talked about Christ-like behavior, and I really kind of would have almost liked to have seen them combined, and some of the behavior and the teachings and things that Elder Robbins had spoken about would to me be part of being a saint. It wouldn't necessarily be going to the temple or getting your priesthood blessings or whatever he spoke about, and it just seemed more, I mean, it was definitely Mormon centric rather than more Christian, you know, general Christian.
Anything from you, Jim? Yeah.
Not really. I mean, it was kind of, I to be quite honest, I kind of zoned out at that point.
Hey, if you made it that far, that's saying something.
Yeah.
All right. Sixth speaker, C. Scott Groh. I'm sorry. I'm not.
Run,
I don't
Jane,
mean
to run.
Make... Yeah, Jane, run. Yeah.
They couldn't. They didn't call up IP Freely. So.
Yeah.
He talks about his brother that had passed away. He said that his brother lived a hedonistic lifestyle, which ended up costing him his church membership.
I don't get that. You know, define hedonistic lifestyle.
Yeah, well, I don't know what that means either. It obviously costed him his membership, boozing around, sleeping around. I don't know.
You know, well, it depends on your bishop, too. But, I mean, when I think of a hedonistic lifestyle, I think, like, you know, a smoking jacket and Hugh Hefner and, you know...
Wow.
You know, two goddesses.
Yeah, yeah. You know, all hail Eris, you know, that kind of stuff.
My viewing companion also expressed frustration, you know, what did he do? Like, what happened? You know, tell us.
Yeah.
You know, it's just all generalities and euphemisms and, you know, it's like, you know, okay, you don't have to tell us, you know, everything about, you know, his meth lab in a mobile home outside of Tucson or, you know, it's like, we don't need to know everything, but just give us something, you know.
But it sounded, you know, I don't want to take this too far, but, you know, it sounded kind of Paul H. Dunnish, you know, in its approach, you know.
I don't know. He said that he even got permission to share the story, but it's like he said
from who?
Yeah, I don't know. His wife, maybe? I don't know.
That's maybe a good question. His brother died, you know.
So. But yeah, he's like he says, my brother was a bad, bad guy, and then everybody's like, well, how bad was he? He was bad. What did he do? I'm not going to tell you that part. Yeah, it brings curiosity up. But
yeah, and to a certain point, I think everyone kind of fills in the blank with their own ideas of what a hedonistic lifestyle is, and it just
that's exactly the point. You know, is you know, to a Mormon, a hedonistic lifestyle is, you know, having a bottle of wine after a nice steak on Friday night. You know,
but the majority of his talk was on the atonement, very Christ-centered, a lot about repentance. But yeah.
I felt like it was a continuation of D. Todd Christofferson's. It was just part two. I thought it was really heavy on guilt and sin. And I'm very sensitive to that because one of my children, really, he took that very much to heart. And it really kind of messed with his head. And so I'm really, really sensitive to how that's presented. And I didn't really appreciate it.
It was a retelling the prodigal son story, you know. To be quite frank,
yeah.
And that's all that it was.
But you're right, Audrey. He was beating the repentance horse pretty heavy there, you know. Anything from you, John B?
Well, I mean, it's nothing we haven't seen in a church video from the early 1990s. So,
yeah.
In which a hedonistic lifestyle means moving to Los Angeles and becoming a photographer.
I remember that seminary video. Oh, my God, the memories.
All right. We're coming up to the seventh speaker, who's my favorite of the session, Jeffrey R. Holland. And he talks about Brigham Young having the dream of the hillside. And he never actually said the quote, "This is the place." I was kind of waiting for him to say that, but he didn't.
I was waiting for him to mention the scouts that told him that that's what they were going to build Salt Lake.
Yeah, but and he also didn't mention Brigham Young being struck with, Rocky Mountain Fever that was causing him hallucinations then at that point, too. And then he mentions the name of the enzyme is not a coincidence because that was referred to in scriptures and by Brigham Young.
It's wordplay.
Yeah.
Well, how could it be a coincidence in that they wouldn't have called it that if it hadn't been referred to in scripture? I mean, it's like no one hears the name of the magazine and just thinks it's a great name on its own right.
It seemed to me that Elder Holland was deeply emotional I mean, he is in most of his talks, but this one, he seemed emotional from start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
He was right. He was, I mean, he came out choked up and he left with tears streaming. It was, I mean, it was really nice. He talked about that, you know, he says, everybody that you've heard in the last 2 days are guided by God in their talks. The one thing that really caught my attention where he says, each speaker is not asked what to speak on. They're asked to fast and pray on their topic, and they worry about what to talk about and God's direction and what they talk about. That was actually pretty interesting, I thought.
Pretty interesting or a fallacy?
I thought it was interesting, Jim. How did you not think it was? I mean, because
we've had this conversation before.
I know, right? But I don't think it's – you know, everybody has those moments where they think, you know, are they planned? Does the First Presidency hand out their topics? Like, okay, you got atonement, you got repentance, you got obedience. I think it's interesting that it sounds like that they don't do that. They say fast and pray and then come up with a topic on your own. It probably, their talks are probably still pre-screened, but I don't know.
I'm sure they at least get bullet points, you know.
I don't know. I don't know.
And because conference after conference, there seems to be a theme. Either that or it's just, you know, the human nature to find patterns, you know, which it might be. But
all right. Well, I was going to say, I think the repetition for me, like the President Monson's talk, you know, yesterday on Saturday about the single men, and then Richard G. Scott's saying, you know, something very similar. Like, I don't think they would plan for that. That to me, I was just saying that when you have two talks that are very similar in theme or mention something, to me, I would guess that's not planned. Like, you probably wouldn't intentionally do that. So, like, President Monson's talk and Elder Scott's talk, where they both really spoke directly to the single young men or the single older men, anyway, that to me says, nah, they didn't probably plan that. That was probably independent.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking. I think it's nice to hear that. I mean, because everybody kind of wonders about that, and it's just nice to hear them speak that. My other favorite line that he says, it's actually my most favorite line of the general conference. He says, we know not everybody's guilty of viewing porn, being domestic, violent with their spouse, what does he say? And not everybody's guilty of what we talk about in conference. We know that many of you here are really trying to do what's right. And give yourself some high marks. That, to me, was so overdue.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, we could use more of that, really.
That was, I mean, yeah, we had to wait till the concluding speaker, pretty much, to get that speech after everybody had pretty much had the guilt off the charts, but it was nice to actually hear that for a change, I thought. And then he talked a little bit of his appreciation for Thomas Monson. And I was watching the Twitter feed during conference on this session, and somebody tweeted in that made me laugh, says, at night, Satan checks under his bed for Elder Holland. Because he's that powerful, I guess.
That's just a rehashed Chuck Norris joke.
Yeah, but it still made me laugh. But any of you guys' final thoughts on Elder Holland?
Yeah, one thing that, you know, I spent so much time online watching the back and forth between critics and defenders of the faith, and one thing that always comes up over and over and over is, you know, the degree to which, you know, conference talks are quote-unquote scripture or inspired, and the defenders of the faith always have to argue that it's rare that something would be scripture in conference. You know, it's the exception rather than the rule. And for the most part, it's just our inspired leaders expressing their personal opinions and their wisdom and knowledge, but it's not the voice of the Lord to us. You know, that's one of the keystones of apologetics in the church, is that you can discount just about anything said in conference.
Oh yeah.
But, Elder Holland's talk, he really, you know, saying everything you've heard has been under the direction of the Holy Spirit, and, you know, he really kind of pushed the needle towards the other end of inspiration being the rule and not the exception. So,
well, apologetics is applying an assumption when it's convenient. That's the definition of apologetics.
Right.
Anything from you, Audrey?
No, I was just a little freaked out to see how old he's getting, because I was at BYU when he became president, and that just made me realize how old I'm getting.
Elder Holland, he's kind of a celebrity. I guess everybody likes President Uchtdorf the best, but yes. Somebody also said in Twitter that Elder Holland and Dallin H. Oaks are like the 80 metalheads of the apostles. And then, of course, we had President Monson wrapping it up. He didn't really say too much. He just said, you know, be safe, travel home, heart is full, thanks to everybody. Here comes Easter. And then he talked a little bit about Easter. Any thoughts about that or the entire session? You guys enjoy yourselves? I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, it was good.
I thought it was a pretty ho-hum session. Nothing real major, I guess. Not like last year.
Yeah.
I'm not like 6 months ago.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't see much of yesterday's conferences, but was there anything that is going to be making headlines?
No.
Just the temples. But
temples and the repeated encouragement to the single men of the church to get married.
Yeah, so why are you guys out? I mean, I guess they included the women, but why are you guys out there wasting your time not married? Come on, let's do this. Women are waiting.
Yeah.
I don't get that message. All right. Well, any final words from any of you? All right.
This is fun.
Yay, conference.
This is lots of fun.
Yeah, I really appreciate you guys joining me. This is the part of conference that I like the most, is being able to voice my opinion. So, Audrey, Jim, John B., thanks for joining me on Mormon Expression, and we'll talk to you guys later.
Thanks
for having us.
Thanks.